Okay, Iris, state your full name and spell it for me.
It's Iris Donita Bowen, and it's spelled I-R-I-S. Donita is D-O-N-I-T-A, and my last name is Bowen, B-O-W-E-N.
Okay. Where were you born?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York.
In what year, please?
1958, Kings County Hospital.
Your date of birth, that's what I meant.
It's 1/17/1958.
Okay, all right. And you said Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, Brooklyn, Kings County Hospital.
Okay, so where did you grow up?
In Brooklyn, East New York, Brooklyn.
And what kind of things you did as a child?
Played games and built snowmen and tag and red light, green light, 1, 2, 3, jump rope, double dutch. You know, things that kids did back then in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Was your residence a house or projects?
Yeah, I grew up in the projects in East New York. Linden houses, and for the most part, when I grew up, it was very integrated, and after a while, it turned over, and, you know, all the other people left. Yep. Which is true. They did.
So, it was mixed, and then...
Yeah, it was mixed. When I was growing up, it was mixed until I got to be about, I would say, in my teenage years. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, what subjects did you like in school?
My favorite subject was art, and I liked, I think I liked social studies. Yeah.
Okay. And your parents, what kind of work did they do?
My father worked for the post office, and my mother was a stay-at-home mom. Yeah, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My father didn't want her to work, so she stayed at home.
Okay. What kind of music did you listen to, and what were some of your favorite artists?
Okay, Stevie Wonder was one of my favorite artists. I listened to R&B. That was about it, R&B. But my favorite artist was Stevie Wonder.
Alright.
That's definite.
So, in high school, did you take any college prep courses?
No, not in college. I went to the...
Yeah,
I mean, not in high school. I went to the High School of Art and Design. And I studied art, and I got a scholarship to go to Syracuse. And I went to Syracuse for a year. It was very cold. That was my first time away from home, so I didn't really study. Elliot used to come visit me there, too.
On campus?
Up in Syracuse. Yep, he did. He came to visit me a few times.
So you graphic or you paint?
I like to paint.
Well, that's a prestigious school for artists.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I didn't know back then when I was 18.
But what, I mean, you had to enter through, like there's a competition to enter. Did you keep some of the art that you did?
I probably did. I think I might have some of it. Mm-hmm. But that was like 18, that was like 50 years ago. Yeah.
So your love of painting kind of
dissipated? No, I still love it. It's just I don't have time now to paint. But I still love painting. I would love to just, if I could just do that, I would be happy and not work.
All right.
And just paint.
Wow. That's a great school, art. Art design. So, when was your first introduction to drugs?
I was about, I would say about 20. Because when I went away to college, there was no drugs. I wasn't exposed to drugs. you know, maybe some alcohol at fraternity parties, but there was no drugs. So I would say like maybe 20, 21 when I met my husband.
Okay.
Yep, he was the introduction.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And where'd you meet him?
In Brooklyn. A friend introduced me to him. Yep.
Okay. How many children do you have?
I have 4 girls and 1 boy now. Recently lost a daughter.
Okay, so what drugs did you start using?
I don't know what it was that he gave me the first time we went out, but and then I started seeing, you know, cocaine and then marijuana. But, you know, I tried a little bit of it, but it wasn't for me, so I didn't stay with it. Yeah, but I tried it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, marijuana, cocaine, and, you know, when I used to work at the hospital, all my friends were, you know, using cocaine, and they had cocaine parties. And on Monday morning, they go right back to work. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But, you know, it wasn't for me, really, so...
Right.
Yeah.
And what, your husband, what kind of work did he do?
He did roofing, he did like maintenance and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he was at Syracuse on a scholarship.
What happened? It was on partial scholarship. What happened was I was there for a year. I was hanging out in the frat houses, partying, not going to school. And I ended up getting pregnant. I was 19. I was going on 19. Yeah, I was 19. And I had my son, so I stopped going to school. Yep. That was in 1976. I graduated from high school in 1976. Went away to school and came back pregnant. Yep. And that was, and my mother wanted to kill me, but. Yeah, because I was partying. I was going to the frat houses. It was my first time out the house, and I was like, I'm partying. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I ended up getting pregnant, and I stopped going to school.
Oh, don't cover up the mic. You want to cover up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I ended up, you know,
yeah,
leaving school.
Oh, all right. So that's kind of a nice school, right?
It was a nice school, yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice campus. I had my own room. Well, I had a shared room. It was me, so I didn't have to be in the dorm. I had a shared room and everything. Yep. Elliot used to come visit me.
Okay.
Yep. He sure did.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, what was your first introduction to incarceration?
Sure.
How that
okay.
kind of come about?
Okay, the first time I got arrested was, I was working, I had a job, okay, let's go back now. So, my husband was dealing drugs after, he was doing construction work, and, I mean, not construction, he was doing roofing, and he was doing, maintenance. And he lost his job. That's when everything just started to fall apart. Because now somebody introduced him to selling drugs. And now I'm carrying drugs and, you know, doing all the criminal activity. So he got arrested. Now I got to take care of the family. So I was getting welfare and I was working. I had a $5 an hour job doing telemarketing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was still getting welfare and I didn't report it. So I got arrested, but they RO-R'd me. So that was my first brush. And even though we were selling drugs and everything, I had never gotten arrested, but this time he got arrested, which left me to take care of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was working, getting the welfare, and they arrested me. They called it grand larceny. And somebody told me that it shouldn't have never been grand larceny because it was like $1,000. It was less than $3,000. And they arrested me. They RO'd me and put me on probation for 5 years.
So where did they came to you, your apartment, or you just on the street, you had some money?
For the first one,
yeah.
I forgot how that happened, but I know I had a court date. They told me, you know, what the charges were, that, They told me what the charges were, and you know they had me appear in court and put me on probation for like 5 years. Meanwhile, he came back out, I think, and you know we were selling drugs the whole time, and as a matter of fact. We had a lot of drugs in the hotel and scales and stuff like that. But I didn't get arrested that time, but because I never said anything. I didn't have anything to do with the drug sale or anything. So I didn't get arrested that time. But he did. And then, oh no, matter of fact, I did get arrested that time. And they wanted me to snitch on him, and I wouldn't. And I stayed in jail for a whole year. Yeah, I think that was the second time. Yeah.
Okay, so that first time, mm-hmm. You remember the year? What year that was?
Yeah, that was like about in 1988.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you was aware of what you were doing. So it was kind of like you knew exactly like what you were that the risks. You understood.
No, I didn't understand the risks, but
okay.
Yeah, I didn't understand the consequences.
The consequences.
Yeah, I didn't understand the consequences, but yeah, I knew what I was doing basically, you know.
So when your husband was incarcerated, was he at Rikers Island or you had to go upstate to see?
Yeah, he was upstate, so.
Okay. You remember the prison? Or you
yeah, know? He was in Dannemora. That's all the way up by Canada. He was in Dannemora and then there's, I think, Comstock. But he was way upstate. I had to take a bus from 59th Street, they used to have this bus that went upstate, and it took like 2 days to get there because they stop at you go like 12 o'clock at night, and then the bus gets you there the next morning. It's a long ride. And then you go to a welcome center, you can comb your hair and put on makeup or whatever, but yeah, it was a long ride.
Do you have your child with you when you were shot?
Mm-hmm, yep. Yep, sure did. And, so it was a lot of traveling around the state with the babies to go see the men. I remember that.
So, traveling. Your brother and you have a brother and sister, right?
Uh-huh, yes, I have a brother and sister.
And so as you was in this new world, What was happening at home with your brother and sister and your mom?
Well, my mom was passed away by then.
Oh, she was okay.
Yeah, she was already gone, but she probably would have passed away if she was.
If
she saw what was going on, because she never liked my husband anyway. So, yeah, she was like, "No, he's not good for you," and I was like, "Oh, but I love him." But she knew what she was talking about. But they were not happy about it because, you know, no one that, you know, we knew of in the family was incarcerated, so.
Right.
You know, yeah, so, yeah, they were not happy at all.
So the first time you got put on probation, mm-hmm. and the second time they gave you a year.
Yeah, I was that. They didn't even sentence me. They were just trying to get me. They were just holding me because they wanted me to snitch on him, and I wouldn't. So they just held me for a year, and I guess after a year, they had to let me go.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. They couldn't hold me no longer.
So was that Rikers?
Mm-mm, no, that was, we had, we were selling drugs upstate.
Oh, you upstate? Oh.
Mm-hmm, yeah, we were selling drugs upstate, like Middletown, up that way. Orange County, yeah.
So the holding prison was what?
In the jail, in the county jail.
Okay.
Yeah, in the county jail.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you had, now what happened to your child when you was in holding?
My sister and my brother took the kids, yeah.
Okay, that's him.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, yeah. Remember Barbara?
Yeah,
Taylor? Barbara took some of the kids and yeah, so.
Now did my mom's, was she in touch with you at that time or not?
Yes, she was. She was. Mm-hmm. Your mom was always supportive, you know, no matter what.
Okay. Yeah. So let's get into so you come out after a year of holding.
Mm-hmm.
You come back to regular life. What transpires then?
Mm-hmm. So I come out, get into transporting drugs back and forth, and doing all kinds of stuff. You know, I just saw my whole life spiraling. I'm just like, because now my husband he's still locked up. Then I get into another relationship with this other guy. He was abusive, and it was just a mess. And, you know, sometimes I'm like, how did that life turn into that life? You know,
yeah,
criminal
right.
behavior, you know. But it was a lot of domestic violence and, you know, so.
So did you, when you were involved with the trade of drugs, did you take yourself or you didn't touch?
I used to sometimes smoke it, you know, put it in a cigarette and smoke it, but not really, not a lot. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like I was addicted or anything like that. Once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is that marijuana, crack, or what?
Not really marijuana. I tried marijuana, but the cocaine, the powder cocaine, I used to put it in the cigarette
mm-hmm.
and smoke it.
So when you were selling drugs, what drugs were
they? Crack, cocaine, no marijuana. It's mostly crack and cocaine.
Cocaine is expensive, right?
So. Yeah, it was expensive, but that was like in the 80s. And we had connections with some Dominicans. Well, he had Colombians, Dominicans, so, yeah. So there was a lot of money. Yeah, there was a lot of money involved. And got a lot of violence, a lot of guns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of guns, weapons.
Firsthand,
yep. I remember being in the drug spot one day, and I had the gun, and he told me, I had a lot of drugs, and he told me, don't open the door. And sure enough, the guy that was on the outside guarding the door, he was like, open the door, pass me the gun. So that was, yeah, a lot of times I saw my life flash in front of me. Yep. Thought I was going to be dead. Mm-hmm.
That's some scary traits.
Yeah,
scary.
It was very scary. And sometimes I think back and I'm like, damn, I would never do that again. I was like, it was dangerous, very dangerous, because you're running from the drug dealers, you're running from the cops, and you're running from the stick-up people. So, yeah, it was very dangerous. Yeah.
So was the, what was your age? You're in your 20s, right?
Yeah, I was in my 20s. It was probably my late 20s because my mother wasn't alive. My mother died when I was like 28. So my late 20s, early 30s is when everything just went. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so, all right, so you're out, you're still selling, you're involved with your drug trade. Did you run into the police again at some point after that first year? You know, how long were you back on the streets?
Let's see. Not long, maybe. Maybe a year or two. Maybe less than a year. No, maybe a year or two. And because once you get into that kind of activity, really, you could just see your life spiraling. But you don't know how to stop it. You just see it going. I guess somebody would have to stop it for you. Somebody would have to, and that's usually the criminal justice system. Yeah. Once you see that, because you can see it in front of you. You're like, this is going to, you can see everything falling apart. It's right in front of you. You can see it.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, what am I going to do? But you keep doing it. You keep doing it. Yeah, you can see it. You know it's about to go down, but you don't think it's going to really happen. But you know something's going to happen. If you keep living like that, you know something's going to happen. But you just keep doing it. I don't know.
So you accept it, or you fight it, or you could fight it, but you just accept it?
Yep, you just accept it, and it becomes a way of life, and, you know. But the whole time, you could see I remember seeing everything in front of me saying something's going to happen. You know how you have the feeling that something's going to happen? I don't know. But something's in front is going to happen. So you could kind of, I did, saw the spiral. Because my life was out of control, you know. And we didn't grow up like that. You know, our parents went to church. They, you know, strict, law-abiding citizens. We didn't grow up like that.
So that was, you know, that's a male-dominated world. So you was a female. What was it like for you?
Well, I didn't really. I was, you know, the females back then, you were just like the mule. I found out later, you called the mule because you carry the drugs. You, you know, carry whatever's necessary, carry the guns or whatever. But you don't really get out in the. There was a lot of violence, a lot of. People tried to kill us, tried to kill the whole family, the kids. It was very, very violent. And I'm like, when I think about it now, I'm like, how did I do that? I would never think about getting into that lifestyle again. It was very dangerous. People tried to kill us. People got killed. Very dangerous lifestyle.
In the sense that, you know, me as an outside person, you hear about, you read about these stories, you know, and you say, you know, someone's got killed by guns and stuff like that.
A lot of violence. If you don't kill them, they're going to kill you.
So you understand.
I have sat at the table with one of my husband's drug dealing friends, and me and one of my daughters, which is Candace. She was about 3 or 4 then, and he had a gun under the table, and me and my daughter's right there, and he's talking to me like nothing. And so her dad was coming in the door, and she must have been by the door, but he had the chain was on the door. But he told her, he opened the door, and these are real stories, I can't. He opened the door, but the chain was on, so he couldn't get in. She had a little chair, and he said, go get your chair and open the door. And she got her chair and climbed up on the chair and took the chain off. That's how he got in. But I probably would have been dead, me and her. Yep. He had the gun right here under the table, and we're sitting talking right across from each other. So it's a lot of that. We had another guy. He was going to kill the whole family. Yep.
This is over a business deal.
Yeah, over drugs.
Over drugs. Because
it was a lot of money. My husband was making a lot of money.
So are we talking like $5,000 a week or more than that?
Probably like $5,000 a day. Yeah, probably like 5,000 a day.
That's
a lot. In Brooklyn, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
Because I was counting a lot of money every day.
So, okay, so you originally you got started on, upstate. No,
in Brooklyn. Yep, originally got started in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Yep.
And how did you get upstate? How did you guys just started selling up there?
Yep, he started selling up there, and you know, we would go back and forth.
Oh, you go back and forth. Okay. So Brooklyn was really rough. Right?
Brooklyn was the roughest place, because everybody's after you. Yeah, in Brooklyn it was really rough because the drug dealers are after you to get your drugs. The addicts are after you because they want some drugs, and the cops are after you because it's illegal.
Right.
Yep, it's illegal, and they, you know, so you, what we used to do when we would leave the spot, we would come out, and my husband would not go forward, but back up out the block because he was always scared somebody would follow him and kill us, and we had many times, many brushes with death. Yeah.
So you have one son. You had another. When did you have a daughter?
Like 2 years after. Yeah, when I was working. Aunt Rosie, when Philip was born, Aunt Rosie, remember Aunt Rosie?
Yeah.
She got me a job working at Kings County.
For the hospital.
Yeah. So I was working at the hospital, doing good. Met this guy. And had Maxine. Yeah, that's where I met Maxine's father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a different guy. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Different guy. And that didn't work out. He used to threaten me, physical violence, and so I went back home to my mother. Yep. So it was me, Maxine, and Phil. And I stayed with my mother for a while. Then I met this guy.
Another guy.
Yep. I met the other kid's father. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was, that's the drug dealer. Then I met the drug dealer. But he wasn't dealing drugs when I first met. Well, I guess he was, because he was the one that first turned me on to whatever, you know, like they say, date rape.
Yeah.
That was a sign for me, but I ignored the sign because my friend introduced me to him. He was tall, dark-skinned, handsome, and I just, went along with it. And by that time, you're like, well, for me, as a woman, I was kind of like beaten down. I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to get married and, settle for him. And bad mistake. Mm-hmm. My mother was like, he's no good for you. And I was like, oh, but I love him. And she was like, she never liked him. Mm-hmm. The whole time.
The whole time.
So, she never liked him.
So now you're in the game. I'm saying the game.
Yep. So I was in the game.
And so your next run-in with the
So in between with him selling drugs and everything like that, the kids got taken away. Because now he went to get, this is in Brooklyn. He went to get some drugs. The cops were following him now. They followed him to the house. He came in. They arrested him right there, and they took the kids.
Hmm.
That's when Barbara took the kids.
Okay.
Yep. Barbara took the kids. And,
Just Maxine and Phil?
No, she took Maxine, and now, then I had the other girls then.
Okay.
Yep.
3 kids.
So, as a matter of fact, we got to roll the tape back.
No problem.
Before that, we had a big fight, me and my husband, and he beat me up, and Phil was about 7, 8, and Phil, witnessed it and everything, and Maxine, they witnessed it, and so Phil went to be with somebody called my sister, and she came to get Phil and Max and took them. But she didn't take the other kids because that was his kids, and he wasn't, you know, he's like, you're not taking my kids. So that's how they got, Phil and Max got to be with his father, and Max was a girl. And so now after that happened, the kids in foster care, and it's just me and him. So we're going now, now we're deep in the drugs. He got arrested. I think we were going back and forth to court. And we were going back and forth to court, trying to get the kids back, and it was just a mess. It was just a complete mess. But now you're in deep because we ain't got the kids. You know, I'm depressed, so I don't care. I don't even care because I don't have the kids, and I just went off the, you know, I didn't care. Yeah, so, yeah.
So you had two. Okay, so you have a total of
five. So kids. That was the.
Yeah, five kids. So you have two by one father.
Mm-hmm. No, the three by one father and the two oldest. Max, Phil, I got pregnant when I was in college.
Right.
So his father lives out in Long Island now.
Yeah.
Then Max, I had with the guy that I was working in the hospital with.
Right.
Yep. And so then I had the three with my husband, the three other girls.
The three other girls.
Mm-hmm.
And his last name was Bowen?
Yep, his last name is Bowen.
Okay, so
mm-hmm.
he was a bigger drug dealer.
He was the drug dealer.
He was.
He was the, he's from Panama.
Oh.
So they, yeah, he's from Panama, so he had the Colombian connections, and yeah.
So, okay, so now you're deep in. So you accepted the fact that, okay, you're going to probably get in trouble.
Yeah, I figured, you know, one day. But you don't think that it's going to happen to you. You don't think. But actually, at that time, I was so distraught about the kids, you know, in foster care. And so I was just like, I don't care. About nothing. You get into that mode like, I don't care about nothing. I don't have my kids. I don't care. But see, that's where the family breakup and all that stuff comes apart. The breakup of the family. Once the family gets broken up, you just like, most of the time, it's just like, I don't care. I'm just going to, you know, spiral out till shit happens.
So,
uh-huh.
So when did they... When did you get the census to Bedford Hills, which was, you spent mm-hmm. a lot of time there. So
that was, was in 92. Yeah, that was in 90. I got arrested in 92, was going back and forth to court, and got sentenced and started doing my time in 92. I had an 8 1/3, a 25, and...
So, minimum to mm-hmm, 25.
Right, minimum.
Life.
Yeah.
To 25, right?
Uh huh, yeah, to 25. And they can keep you in there until you're 25. But, you know, you go to the parole board after the 8 years, and then they can decide, all right, I'm going to hit her another 2 years, depending on your behavior.
Right.
Mm hmm. And they can do that all the way up to, which they do.
So, yeah. So at that time, to get the eight to 25,
mm-hmm.
did they deem you a certain level of drug dealer? Because that's not a little time.
Yeah, no. Oh,
or
yeah,
the system was just hitting people hard no matter what.
Yeah, that plus, you know, your other charges, they look at that, you know, and the weapons, and yeah, they look at all that. They put all that together, so...
So you was around weapons, but you didn't use them.
Oh, yeah, I used them, too. Yeah, I used them, too.
Wow.
Yeah. You got to, it's either my life or their life. That's how that goes, so.
So on a typical drug deal, obviously, mm-hmm. both sides have guns.
Yep, and it's either you're going to kill me or I'm going to kill you. Yeah, so.
So you just... Mm-hmm. If you're making a transaction, you don't want to kill nobody, so you just
no, you don't. But
you just want to do the transaction,
right? But if you have to save your life.
Oh, if something goes wrong.
Yeah, yeah. If you have to save your life, you're going to, yep, you're going to use that weapon. And, you know, that you don't, in your mind, you don't set out to say, oh, I'm going to kill somebody. But, yeah, if you, it's either you're going to die or they're going to die in that game, in the drug game. Yeah.
So none of your, were any of your offenses violent or just?
Yeah, violent, yeah.
Assault?
Yeah, yeah, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, see, I didn't know that.
Cause mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So you got the 825.
Mm-hmm. And I did 16 out of that. So they kept hitting me every 2 years. 2 years, 2 years, yeah.
So, and I was 16 at Bedford?
Yep. And, well, I left Bedford in 99. Then I went to Albion, which is up in Albion, New York. I did, like, 5 years there. Then I came down to Bayview in the city, and I did about 3 years, 4 years in, about 4 years in Bayview. Yeah, and then I left on a conditional release.
Mm-hmm. But how long were you at Bedford, though?
Bedford, I was there like maybe 9 years.
Okay, so let's go back to the...
About 7 years in Bedford, yeah.
What was the other prison's name? Anna? What was it?
Albion.
Albion. Okay, so let's and go. Let's
back
go
to
back.
Albion?
Yeah, let's go back there. What was a typical day like?
Oh, in Albion? A typical day, because that's upstate New York. A typical day, you feel like you're in a slave camp. That's a typical day in Albion. You have to get up. You got to go to your programs. It was a lot of snow up there. They don't care if it's a snowstorm. They have you out in the... in the snow, doing fire alarms. Yeah. Somebody's at the door. Yeah.
Okay. So, you need to answer? Yeah, go ahead. Oh.
Okay.
Wait. So, you was telling me a little bit about what a typical day like was at
Albion.
Right.
I remember my first night there, the officer said, "All you crackhead bitches on the count." And I was like stunned. And I was like, oh, I got to get out of here. Because, that was his. He's like, oh, I know all you girls are from New York City. It's a big dorm with bunk beds, and it's about 200 women in a dorm. 100 to 200 women, and you know, it's just lines of bunk beds. And the officer was standing above them, and he was like, oh, you crackhead bitches, and that's what Albion was like.
Mm.
Yeah, a lot of raping. And
did the guards get away with it?
Yeah, they did.
Wow.
Of course they did. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, at that facility, it's supposed to be called like a correctional facility.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any opportunity for corrections to learn or build a career or anything? Is there any? or is it all just straight punishment?
Yeah, straight more punishment. Bedford Hills was more of correction, correct your life, get your life together, you know, therapeutic. Bedford gave you the opportunity to go to school to, you know, make the changes if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Albion was not that kind of facility. It was more like punishment.
It's all women?
Yeah, all women. All the facilities are all women. They don't mix the women with the men anymore. They used to back in the day, but I heard up in Albion, as a matter of fact, a lot of women were getting pregnant and, you know, so. Yeah. So, yeah.
So guards would impregnate them? Or
yeah,
would?
Guards. Yep. Yes, the guards, the other inmates, but mostly the guards. Yeah.
So they at that, I believe that wasn't a crime at that time, right?
No, it was not. It's a crime now. It was not. I know a girl that just did about 30 something years. She had a baby in there with the guard, with the officer. And the little girl is about, she's about 30. Mm. Yeah, she's about 30 now.
Wow.
Yeah, and that her father was one of the guards. Yeah.
Okay, so what's, so you at that facility, what was the relationship with your children, your family? I know my mother was writing you at some point.
Mm-hmm, right, what, your mother came to visit me in Albion, as a matter of fact, your mother and father. They came to visit me in Albion. Yeah, they sure did. But it was so far, it was like 8 hours away. So, yeah, they came to see me once. I didn't see the kids much then because it was so far. So the relationship is like distant. You know, they have programs where you, you know, write the kids and send them books and, you know, other stuff like that. But it's very distant. Once you get up to Albion, that's like a punishment place. They send you up there. It's like you're away from your family, you're away from the city. So the goal is to get back down to the city, like Bayview. That was like a goal, to get to Bayview, because now your family can visit you.
How do you spell that facility?
Bayview?
No,
Albion, A-L-B-I-O-N, Albion Correctional Facility.
So in other words, so you didn't. Never lonely with you,
only time alone. Okay, let me turn it down. Okay.
So with your kids, basically, mm-hmm. You're saying you didn't know what your kids were doing?
No, not unless by mail or phone or, no, very distant.
And did the kids write?
They wrote to me. they wrote, and you send them pictures and, you know, mail and books and stuff like that. So, but very distant, very hard, very tough.
Okay.
Yeah, very tough.
So when you were at Albion, you went to Albion in your first. The first 8 years of this?
No, that was the second part of the bid.
The second part of the bid.
Uh-huh.
So once
your time goes down, they send you to the medium, the minimum, the max. Because Bedford is the max.
Oh, Bedford is the max, okay.
Mm-hmm. Then they send you to, once your time starts going down, then they send you to a medium or minimum. And Albion is the medium. Then you go to Bayview, that's the minimum. So that means whoever's in Bayview, they're going home soon.
Oh, they're going home
uh-huh.
soon?
Okay. Yeah, they're going home soon.
So what's a typical day like at Bedford?
Bedford was more like program, get yourself together. You got the opportunity. So they had school. They had, therapy. They had everything. If you want to take advantage of it, they had everything there to get your life together. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, as a long, like, spending years, like, what's the mindset when you're up there? Like, I mean, do you read,
you keep your mind occupied, or else you'll go crazy. And in Bedford, you get a lot of visits with the kids. They had a bus program where they bring the kids in, you know, they could get the bus from Brooklyn and come up to visit your parents. They had all kinds of programs in Bedford to keep your relationship going with the kids, and phone calls, you could get phone calls, all kinds of stuff. But then once you get to Albion, all that is just like, mm-hmm, that stops. But a typical day in Bedford is you're programmed. You have to be in a program. You're not going to be just laying around in bed all day. You're either going to go to your program, which could be, I used to do teacher's aid.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would help out tutoring in the classroom. And then they had the college program. So I would tutor for the college program and do, math tutoring, stuff like that. So, yeah. So. Yeah, so I did those kind of jobs, you know, tutoring and, yeah. But it's, yeah, they're your program there. Oh.
So you felt, when you were in that system, you felt this is your punishment for crimes.
For crimes, yeah. You feel like this punishment.
You don't feel like the system is treating you wrong. This is kind of like
Yeah. But sometimes, depending on certain things, you feel like, yeah, the system is, yeah, the system is wrong. The system, you know, needs to look at the circumstances and stuff like that. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, you feel like you're being double victimized. Yeah, so.
So did you socialize with other inmates?
Oh, yeah, yeah. These are my friends that I met in prison, and we're still good friends. Mm-hmm. 30 years later, we're still good friends. That's Kathy, that's Sharon, Missy. These two work at Columbia, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
Yeah, they work in the social work department. But, and this is Eve Ensler. She wrote the Vagina Monologues.
Oh.
Yeah, that's her. She used to come into Bedford and do writing classes with us. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of people in Bedford, a lot of authors. Hetty Jones, who is Baraka. Baraka's wife.
Yeah.
Hetty Jones is her real name, but
yeah.
He changed his name. She was, what was his name? Amiri. Yep. She was married to Amiri, so she used to come in and do poetry with us. And I have a few published books too.
Of your own?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not of my own, but you know, in collaboration, we did a research project. And with Hetty, we did a poetry book. So, yeah, I have a few. Mm-hmm. You know who published books, too? Aunt Betty has a few books that she wrote.
Right.
Or children's books.
Yeah, I believe I saw one of those.
Mm-hmm.
You're there at Bedford Hills. You're socializing with other inmates. Was it direction to get out or just?
It's direction to get out, to, you know, reunite with your family. Most of the women want to reunite with the children and family. Yeah.
Now at Bedford, what were the prison guards like? Were they women or men?
Both, women and men. And in Bedford, for the majority of the officers, they were decent. Men and women, most of them are majority African American, and they were pretty decent. I guess they understood the plight, so they were pretty decent. They, you know, they coach you to get your life together. They encourage you, for the most part, to get your life together. Some of the other ones were not so nice. Some of the white officers were not so nice. You know, like I had one tell me, oh, get to the back of the line just like you do on the bus. You know, little comments like that. But
yeah,
I didn't play with them. And but for the most part, the officers in Bedford were decent.
Right. Yeah. Now, did, what was your experience in the prison yard? I mean, and did you go in the yard and what kind of food?
The food was, in the beginning, the food was good, and then over the years they changed it to this thing called Quick Chill, and that was like soy, and it was just nasty. But in the beginning they had fresh food, eggs and hamburger meat and chicken, and they used to do a lot of stealing from the mess hall, yeah, and cook on the unit, because they had stoves on the unit, so we would get food from the mess hall and take it upstairs and cook it. It was illegal, of course, but, you know, if we wanted fresh food, that's what we did, and, yeah.
Was it 3 meals or 1 meal?
3 meals a day. You get your 3 meals, get up, The chow was like 7 o'clock for breakfast, or before, I forgot what time, like seven. And then they had lunch and then dinner. Yeah, you could, when they say three meals, a hot and a cot, yeah, that's what they mean. They, you get your three meals and you're going to get a cot to sleep on.
Oh, yeah. So was it dormitory style or cells?
Different style. Some of them in Bedford, they had cells, they had dorms. It depends on how you, your behavior. You can move up to your own room with a TV and that kind of stuff. And they had like a cottage in the back. That was for honor, you know, honor floor and honorable, you know, people that didn't get in trouble. And, yeah, so yeah, they have different phases. So you come in, you in a dorm with like...
So you studied in school, right? Did you get your degree?
I did get my degree. When I was in Bedford, I got an associate's. There's no school in Albion that you could get a degree, and none really in Bayview. So when I got out, I had like 90-something credits. I went back to school, and I graduated with my bachelor's, then I went back to school and got my master's. Yep, and then I got my license, so. Yep, I was going to school ever since I've been home because I said, damn, I can't sit. I said, first of all, I'm female, I'm black, and I have a felony. That's three strikes. I'm like, what am I gonna do to change my life? So I said, you know what, I can't sing like Michael Jackson, I can't dance, let me go to school.
Okay. Yep.
So that's what I did, and you know, now I got my license in social work, and
Do you go back into the days where you originally got your scholarship to Syracuse? Because that should have made you proud. I mean, if it was me, a scholarship to Syracuse would be
To Syracuse. Yeah, but I just didn't know. I didn't realize the worth. So now, years later, you realize the worth. But I didn't realize the worth then. I'm like, I'm going to the party. I'm not in my mother's house. My mother was strict. And I'm like, I'm not in my mother's house. And, you know, they were strict back then. They didn't play with us at all. You know, your mother and father was,
It was definitely like tight.
No, strict. You're going to go to school. You're going to do what you need to do. And, yeah. So when I got away, I'm like, my mother ain't here. I was having a ball on the campus.
So you did Bedford Hills, you did Albion.
Albion, then to Bayview.
And then to Bayview. And through all that, did you have, by the time you was getting ready to get released, did your children know you, or they had to eventually get to know you once you came out?
They would come, they visited me a lot in Bayview, because it was right in Manhattan. So I got to see them a lot in Bayview. By that time, I became a grandmother, and, you know, they would bring the kids to see me, and, you know. But, you know, we had to start a relationship all over again when I got home, because, you know, now they were, like, older, and, yeah. But they used to visit me all the time, yeah, when I got down to Bayview. And now they have a project going on. They're turning Bayview into a women's building. So they asked women that did time there to be on the committee. So I'm on the committee.
Okay.
And so Candace didn't even want to come back to the building. You know, my daughter, Candace, she didn't even want to come back because they had an open house. They wanted the families to come. Candace was like, I can't come back here. Because she remembered when she used to visit. She was like, I can't. She met me outside, and she was like, I can't come in here.
Mm.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's why I said it's good to talk to the children to see what effect it had on the children.
Right.
Yeah, because we forget about the children and the effects of incarceration on the children. And
so you mentioned a little bit about how the children, they have to, when you're in school, they hide.
Yeah, they hide the fact that, you know, they have somebody incarcerated in their family or their mother, their father. It's hard. It's tough. I remember Phil, he was graduating from I don't know if it was junior high or high school, and he told me that he felt bad because he was the only one that his mother wasn't there when he was graduating. That made my heart, I felt like my heart was going to fall out of my chest.
Mm.
Yeah, because he was like, oh, I wish you was there. You was the only, I was the only one that didn't have their mother there. I'm like, my heart, that's deep. My heart just like dropped to the floor. I was like, and that's when you, if you have a conscience or anything, that's
yeah.
when you know that this has to change. This, you can't do that to, you know. And my brother Henry came to see me when I was in Bayview, and he was like, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I can't see you like this, you know. So it's deep. Yeah. So when you get incarcerated, people think it's just that person. Your whole family is incarcerated. Yeah. Your whole entire family gets incarcerated. Your mother and father, they weren't young, but they were coming. Your mother would come to see me, and of course Uncle Elliot would go everywhere with her, and you know. Yep. So you see, you know, it's like, damn, my whole family is incarcerated.
Yeah, they love me, live with
it. Yep.
So
that's right.
Your sister Gail, did she see you or she?
She did, but not very sporadic. I would say maybe once or twice during the whole time. She didn't really.
But being sisters, that's gotta be deep. That's gotta
yeah,
be deep.
That was deep.
It could be unspoken.
It was very deep, unspoken. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very deep, unspoken, you know.
Mm.
Yes, very deep.
So you, as you look back on your life, and do you reflect on these, the past moves that you make, or it's just something that happened?
No, you reflect on that and be like, what the hell was I thinking? How did that happen? Coming from our family, which is, you know, our family is like straight,
straight people, 90%
straight
of us.
Up. Yep, 90% straight up.
Hard working.
You know, strictly
yeah.
law abiding, church going citizens.
Yes,
that's our family.
Yes.
Yep. And if you go outside of that, then it's a problem.
Wow. That.
Yeah. Yeah. And you could go from generations of our family. They strictly, you know, hard working people. Yep. Mm-hmm.
But see, where you're at now, you're very level-headed. So what's that like being saying, okay, I went through this.
Yep, I went through.
But I understand.
Yeah,
what I went through.
Mm-hmm. I understand, and you know, sometimes I try to think, well, maybe it was a purpose for me to go through these experiences, like domestic violence. One time I was homeless. You know, when we were. As a matter of fact, we had an apartment in Brooklyn, and because at that time the law came out about if you're selling drugs in Section 8, we got kicked out. So, yeah, so we were homeless, going from his friend's house to, you know, hotels, and yeah. So I've been through that, homelessness, domestic violence. So sometimes I'm like, damn, is that why I got this job, to be more compassionate to people that are coming home that have those experiences? I don't know, but because I'd be like, oh God, what's going on here? But you know, now I, you know, went to school, got my license, and I'm like, you know what, I've been home since 2007, so 11 years now, this month, 11 years. Yep. So and all my friends that, you know, went through it, they all have their degrees. She's got her PhD, she's got her master's in urban, she's got her license in social work, she's studying for her clinical. So that's the people that, you know, I'm around today, people that have progressed and are about something, not going back to that life.
So let's talk about the life a little bit, because this life is not in a vacuum. It's a community.
It's a community.
And so there's other, like you mentioned, there was other drug dealers. There's customers who buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And
customers.
So that whole, your whole peer pressure kind of thing.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Do you see anything as far as Black America, where this experience is not just you, it's kind of massive.
Yeah,
you know, whereas other people, you understand?
It's massive. It's massive.
Same thing. What happened to?
Yeah, it's massive. It's massive, and it's, I think it's bigger than us. It's bigger than me and you, but I see it as kind of an attack on the Black family because it's designed to. It's the whole design is, like, now I see it so clear that, because, you know, I see people coming home every day now, and especially for the Black male, the whole setup. If I come home and I can't get my ID, I can't get, you know, okay, so first of all, when you go to DMV, you need 6 points of ID. If I'm locked up for 25 or 30 years, I don't have any ID for the most part. Mm-hmm. So I come home, I have to try to get my social. Maybe I don't even have that. So now I can't work because I don't have my social. Or they have child support and they take away the license. So they can't, you know, drive, can't get a driving job. So the whole system is set up. Then now it's housing. They can't get housing. So the thing was for a lot of guys inside, oh, I can get Social Security when I come out. Okay, you can get Social Security, which is hard to get anyway. But once you get it, that's like $9,000 for the entire year. They may get like $800 a month. So now they can't even afford to apply for housing because they can't afford it, especially affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all designed. It's all a design to, yep. And they're like, how can I get a job? I can't even get my ID. So you're right. So I'm going to go back to my same old life because that's, what else do you, that's all you know.
Ah.
And you got to survive.
Right, it's your environment.
It's just your environment. So the guy in the corner is going to be like, oh, I'm going to give you a couple of, you know, a couple of dollars. You sell some drugs for me and, you know, what you going to do? You can't get public assistance. You can't get this. You can't. All the doors are closing. So you got to be really strong even after this to really stand up and say, you know what? I'm not going to let the system get me. You did get me once, but yeah, with housing, public housing, a lot of guys grew up in public housing.
Right,
now you can't go back because you were selling drugs. You can't go back then. A lot of them don't know how to open a bank account or none of that. They've never had credit, never had a job, all of that. So all that whole systematic thing is all, yeah.
These are grown men.
And these are grown men.
And women.
These are grown men and women. And so that whole system is not designed to help them or help us. It's not. You better help yourself. You better know how to get up and get your shit together and help yourself. So now, I knew all these obstacles were out there for housing and everything. So I said, you know what? I'm going to buy my house. I'm going to buy me a house. They can't tell me. And I wanted to experiment and see what would happen if you have money.
Okay.
They're not going to ask you, do you have a felony? But if you go to get an apartment, they're going to say, oh, you have a felony. You can't get this apartment. But if you go to that bank with some money, they're going to ask you if you got a felony. And I tested it. They ain't asked me not one thing about being arrested. As long as I had that money for that mortgage payment, they don't care about nothing else. And that's how the system is. And I said, they're not going to tell me where I can live and where I can't live. And sure enough, they didn't say nothing. If you got that money for that, but a lot of people don't know, a lot of us Black folks, you don't know that they have a lot of money out there where you can, they will put money in your hands to buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
First time home buyers, minority grants and all that stuff we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you know what? I'm going to fix them. They're not going to tell me where I can live. And so me and her, we were real close.
Okay.
And so we both said, we used to talk about it when we were inside, that when we get out, we're going to buy a house. And she has a condo now. She bought a house too, not too long ago. But we said, all right, let's see what's going to happen if we have, and you don't even have to have a lot of money, maybe $1,000 to put down. And they will put down the rest. But see, they don't teach us this kind of stuff. They don't tell us this, so we don't know. Yeah.
So is there a common thread while you were in prison that these stories are similar?
Yeah.
That, okay, you're from.
Yes.
You know, we didn't get into what it was, what Brownsville is. Well, what did Brownsville become? Because you grew up there.
Yeah, East New York. I grew up in East New York.
Yeah. So it became this whole aura of almost everybody in East New York is going to go to prison.
Yeah, that's right. The drugs. It was the drugs and the violence in East New York at that time. But for the majority, the most of the women in prison have been in domestic violence situations. Most of them got in trouble with a man, through a man, domestic violence.
So they fought back.
They fought back, or they acted out in other ways. But yeah, domestic violence. 98% of the women in Bedford Hills have been molested, raped, been in domestic violence. Yep. And talking to the women, most of them, the majority.
That's a lot.
Have been in traumatic situations. It is. It's true. It's true. The women I talk to, any traumatic situation. And now that I'm doing this job, talking to the men, same thing. Yep, foster care, molestation. You would be surprised how many men I talk to that have been molested in foster care, in different homes. I'm really floored. Yep. Very traumatic situations. One guy, his mother left him under the bench in a box. Never saw her again. And in foster care, he used to come here and talk to me, cry all the time. He was raped, molested. The foster brother used to have him doing all these sexual acts. And yeah, so then you understand what happened to him. You were hurt, and you ended up, you know, hurting people and doing, you know, drugs and crimes. And yeah, I don't think anybody wakes up and says, oh, I'm gonna commit a crime, unless they really, you know, into doing crime. But there's a reason behind what happened. And so most of these guys, yeah, and they've been hurt, and they just say, like, fuck it, I'm just gonna, you know, hurt other people. Like Oprah said before, hurt people. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. And it's like, oh, damn, that's what happened. Another guy, he's on some heavy drugs all the time. He stays drugged up. But when he was like 5, his mother jumped in the train tracks with him, and they separated them. He never saw his mother again. Put him in foster care, same thing, raped, molested. And so he'll be fine for a month, and then he'll start using drugs again. And then he'll get locked up. And then, yeah, and so it's a cycle. Yeah. But they never treat him.
So the system doesn't treat you?
No, they don't treat them. They come out just like they went in 25 years later, same way. Same way. Yep. No therapy, no, like, I don't even think they ask them, what happened to you when you were a kid? I don't even think they ask them, what happened? But when they get here and they get comfortable with you, then they say, you know, when I was in foster care, I got raped. You know, my foster brother used to force me to do sexual acts with him, you know. And it's like, okay, that's why, you know, that happened. Mm. That's how you got into that cycle of violence or robbery and, you know, whatever they do. But
So when you were into, because I know you was away when East New York became very, very violent. Like everybody, the newspapers were terrible stories.
Yeah, a lot of violence in East New York. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was there during them times, the 80s. It was the 80s, and very violent. A lot of shootouts, because there was a lot of drugs. Yep, a lot of drugs in East New York. Yeah, but now I laugh when I see they have the affordable apartments and they have Livonia Terrace and all that. I'm like, East New York? I'm like, what? People are definitely afraid. If you ask anybody about East New York, they're like, I'm not going to East New York.
Yeah, it was bad.
It was bad. It was like the worst part of Brooklyn.
So were you selling in East New York?
We were selling big drugs in East New York. That's the time when I told you I had a bunch of 8-balls and I had the gun, and the guy was like, oh, could you, like, he knocked on the door and he was like, oh, pass me the gun. And I was like, damn, I'm about to die. If I give him this gun, he's going to shoot me and take all the drugs and the money. Mm-hmm. Yep. He was like, pass me the gun. Somebody's out here. I'm like, but I almost did it, but I was like, nah, because he's going to shoot me and take all the drugs. I had all the drugs and the money. My husband had gone out to get more or get something. And the guy was supposed to be watching me in the house and make sure nobody gets it. But he was going to get all the drugs and the money.
Because
he knew it was in there.
So your current position now is
mm-hmm.
what's the exact function? Because you're working.
I'm a program coordinator of the Coming Home program. So I see formerly incarcerated people when they come home, and our goal is to get them healthy. So we want them to see a doctor first. Once you see the doctor, then I do assessments on them and follow up to make sure that, you know, they're getting their housing and their, you know, if they need education. So we meet them with, you know, wherever they're at. So whatever they need, they might need a job, they might need housing, they might need education, you know, might want to go back to school for GED, go back to college. And so that's what I do. So I, you know, work with them around reentry issues. But first, to make sure they get to see the doctor.
Okay, and so incarceration has something to do with the mentality, right? A little bit.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Okay. Right, so we have mental health here. So, you know, whatever needs, what we do an assessment, and whatever needs they have, plus if they're on parole will give them mandates, do anger management, do drug treatment. But, you know, when they first come in, we greet them, we do an assessment, and, you know, just try to help them get back on their feet.
So, are they coming from referrals?
Some of them are referrals
from the prison.
From the prison, some from parole, probation, you know, different places, friends.
Okay, so they hear about it.
Yeah, they hear about it.
Okay, and I didn't get a chance to ask you about that. You mentioned parole and mm-hmm. the parole board, because when you get a long time,
mm-hmm.
every certain amount of time.
Yeah, every 2 years. It depends on what they.
What happens in a parole board session?
They interview you. What have you done to progress? Da da da. What happened with the crime? How did your life get like this? And da da da. And then they make a decision if they think you're able to live in society or not. And sometimes it's just that they just want to hit you because the crime never changes, the person changes. But they hit a lot of people just because, you know, they'll say the nature of the crime, they don't want to let you go in society and da-da-da. So, yeah. So it's an interview. They interview you. Just like when I went to get my license, I had to go in front of a moral board. Yep. You have to go in front of, because you have a felony, you got to go in front of a moral board, see if you're technically moral. Well, so any little thing they have just to hold the rope on you, they.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
I was so furious. I was like, I've been home 10 years, and you're going to ask me if I'm moral? I never had no more trouble with the law. You know, I've successfully completed parole, all of that. And you're still going to ask me, am I moral? So, yeah, you have to. She did too. She went for her social work license. And she had to go for a moral board. She went at 125th Street in the state building. But yeah, that's the stuff that goes on.
So, mm-hmm. But in prison, when they say a parole board, is that mm-hmm. like 3 or 4?
Yeah, it is. 3 or 4. It could be a mix of men and women. And they sit in front of you and they interview you and ask you all these questions about, you know, your life, how did you grow up, and, you know, what happened and this. Yeah, it's three. men, usually. Maybe one woman. Because the parole board is appointed by the governor. That's his people.
Oh, see, they're not guards or anything. They're not.
They're commissioners.
They're coming from somewhere else.
Yep, they're commissioners. Yep, and they're appointed by the governor. So if you know if he's like Pataki in the Pataki era, he's gonna tell his board, his commissioners, don't let them out, no matter what, keep them inside. But somebody like Cuomo is like, oh, let them go. Their board might be a little softer. Yeah, but they're hard.
That's
political. It's exactly political. Yep, it's exactly political. And you know what I equate prison to now? 1864, when they freed the slaves, right? So-called freed the slaves. They said, okay, you're free, you can go. But we didn't have no skills. All we knew about was working on the farm, right?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm going, I don't have no place to live. I don't have no money. I don't have no skills but farming. So where am I going to go to progress? Now, when you leave prison, you know what they give these men, these grown men? They give them $40 and a bus ticket. That's what they get when they leave prison. No housing, nowhere to go. Most of them go into the shelter. How you want them to really progress? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing changed since 1864. Nothing changed. $40 and a bus ticket. That's it. That's what you get when you leave prison.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so where are you supposed to strive with that?
Wow.
Yep.
So as we go, we'll wrap this up for now. Do you have anything you would like to say about your experience with the mass incarceration system? And where you see it going further before, in the years coming?
I see it as something that we need to deal with because men and women alike are going in, getting involved, and it's a lot has to do with poverty, and it's just the whole big picture. But once they get in there, we need to treat them. We're not treating people, and these people are coming home, and they're coming home with the same issues that they went in with, unless we treat them. You know, they're like corrections. Part of correcting them would be to find out what happened with them. For me, that's what I would think. Part of them being corrected is therapy, find out what happened. They don't even ask them, what happened to you? You got raped when you were a kid? Oh, okay, I get it, I understand. Nobody hears them, nobody hears their story. You know, being left under that bench and you never see your mother again. And then the people that are supposed to take care of you, they don't take care of you either. Well, what you think I'm gonna do? Now I'm gonna start robbing people, I don't care. And that's their attitude until, you know, sometimes they may get therapy, but for the majority, they don't get therapy. When they come here, I suggest we have psychiatrists, psychologists, we have substance abuse, because we're about wellness and getting primary care. So we, you know, I suggest to them, you know, do you ever have therapy? You ever talk to anybody about it? No, I never told anybody about it. You would be so surprised to hear how many men got molested and raped by a family member, by, you know. Yep. And then that makes me think, oh, that's why they acted in that way.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. That's why they didn't care about going out and robbing people and, you know, hurting anybody, because they didn't care. Why? Nobody cared about them. Yep. So they thought, why should I care about anybody? Yep. In their mind, they hurt me, they raped me, you know, I was in the street. This guy right here,
mm-hmm.
He did 30-something years, about 33 years. Came home, was doing good for a while. He was in Fortune Society and OD'd. Good guy, nice guy, but he never had a bank account, never knew his mother was a prostitute. So, you know, imagine that growing up. His sister got killed in front of him. And so imagine what his mom was going through. So he was out there robbing people, you know, doing, he did 33 years. Came home, he used to ask me, oh, can you help me get a bank account? I don't know how to open up a bank account. I never had a bank account, you know, never had a real job. So this is the kind of people that, you know, society, we just forget about them and be like, well, whatever. But, you know.
You would think if it's called the correctional system, yeah. And you would, there would be some correction.
Yeah.
Because the person is there so long.
Yeah, no, but it's about punishment. It's punishment. That's what the real thing
That's
is punishment.
That's the real story,
okay. But it's not corrections.
Oh.
Yeah, because they have never asked. They never asked him what happened to him. Why did your life turn out like that? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, well, it's been great. Iris, I appreciate the time.
It's good.
I'll be in touch with you on
it. Yep, if you need any more, just let me know. Okay. Yeah.